This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So here we go. This is going to be a talk on the relationship between new developments in psychology, especially in exploring the way that infants' attachment to their caretakers determines their future personality styles and challenges. And what Buddhism, especially old Buddhism, some of the concepts that overlap with these insights, and also how we can use our practice to work with any early traumas that we might have experienced. So here goes. When an infant is with its caretaker, it's looking for what's known as a secure attachment. Some people refer to this as good enough parenting. And secure attachment has basically three forms to it. One is monitoring it. The infant wants to know that it's seen by the caretaker. So when it looks over, it sees that it's has a connection, and that connection is secure. And even if the connection becomes broken, the mom or father has to go, the caretaker has to go somewhere or give their attention to something else, the caretaker restores the connection, making it clear that they're present again and that it's ongoing. The second thing that an infant needs is mirroring, which is basically the parent or the caretaker lets the infant know that it sees the infant's emotional state. It knows if the infant is frightened or curious or frustrated. And the parent will signal this by, with their face, literally creating a look that mirrors the child's emotional state. So if the child's, the infant's crawling, and this is attractive, and an old man for you acting like a baby, but I'll do it because these are the links I go for you. And so the infant crawls, and it is near another kid that's bigger, so it's scared, and it looks over at its mother, and the mother will go, whoo, to acknowledge that it sees fear and concern in the infant. And this is important because mirroring lets an infant know that its emotions are not unusual or wrong, that they're accepted. And then finally it requires marking. And marking is the way that the mother says, even though I know you're frightened, even though I know you are frustrated or you're upset, I'm okay. I know what you're going through. It's your emotional state is okay, but I am in a secure position where I can help you. So, and what the mother, how the mother will do this, if the infant's frightened, the mother will first make a frightened face, and then it'll make a smile or something that reassures the infant that it's okay, that things are still under control. So it's mirroring and marking back and forth that establishes partly that secure connection. Now, if you're lucky and you have secure connection, what happens is the infant feels safe to explore the world, and they won't have to constantly monitor the caretaker to make sure that they're paying attention. And studies by Ainsworth and Bowlby and D.W. Winnicott and so many other childhood psychologists have established that these patterns go off into adult life, where if people have secure attachments in infancy, they are very likely to be people who explore the world and relationships with confidence, knowing that their emotions are acknowledged and accepted and are not unusual. But if we have a case where there's insecure attachment, just putting it out there, you don't have to. Okay. Don't feel alone. Nobody else is raising their hand, but I know that you're... All right, there we go. So this is only one of Vinny's challenge exercises. Who has, you know, IAP, okay? I had insecure attachment. So if that's the case, that the infant is so worried because the caretaker has not been... is either constantly... engaged in other pursuits, is narcissistic, or is judgmental and rejects a lot of the child's emotions. The child feels this need to constantly check in. There are even worse scenarios. There's avoidant attachment where the mother's completely narcissistic, or the father's completely narcissistic, or the caretaker, whoever, is completely narcissistic, and the infant generally winds up to grow into an adult that is completely self-dependent, suspicious of any intimacy, doesn't want to make connection with anyone because it doesn't believe that there's any connection to be had. And then there's, of course, abusive situations. And what often happens with abusive situations where there's violence or sexual abuse or complete disappearance by the caretaker, very often the child will grow up to be an adult that repeats the abuse in an attempt to master it in adult life, what they were a victim of in childhood. So one of the things that happens when we're trying to get connection with first caretakers and then with the people we're socialized with is we have these authentic behaviors. These are the spontaneous things that we do, the desires that are natural to us, the behaviors that are natural to us. And if we are lucky to be accepted, we can feel confident to act out on those authentic desires. What happens though in a lot of cases of socialization from infancy through schooling and on is that we have to abandon some of our authentic desires and behaviors and present to others something that we see will be rewarded with attention. For example, growing up as a guy, other boys, they're horrible. What can I say? They're horrible. You know, I couldn't give a shit about sports. I'm completely uncoordinated. I have no ability to judge the flight of a ball in the air, nor an understanding why I should. You know, you hit the ball, you deal with it. Don't give me this thing, you know. But there you are. So you have to develop what's known as performative behaviors, gender expectations. Well, for my dad, I had to be tough. I was not a tough kid. I'm not a tough guy. But for my dad, anything that was weak or feminine was a girly boy or a mama's boy, and that was not allowed. So I had to suppress any feminine, any authentic, you know, desire behavior that didn't fit, just to survive my family and to survive socialization. Over time, these performative behaviors that we present to the world to get love and attention from others, to socialize and to be accepted, they turn into what the Buddha called anusayas and what we call coping strategies. They're just ways to get love at any cost. And the problem is if we're constantly trying to get love by achievement and careers or by being perfectionist, or by always being funny, or by always being, you know, on top of the game and independent, then we have to suppress all of the authentic, innate behaviors that don't fit that performance. And then we might wind up at the end, the tail end of life, standing up there with a trophy, an award, a career that was fantastically successful and acknowledged by everyone, but inside we feel completely hollow because the entire act was not authentic. It was something we developed because we didn't feel innately we deserved love or would get love. So we just did what other people said was the right thing to do, and we chased that. Of course, it's very tempting to say, well, why not just always be authentic? Hey, fella, be authentic. In that voice, exactly that voice. No idea why that voice came. It's the Brooklyn in me. Anyway, fella. It's not that easy because we have from infancy on this fear that if we act authentically, we act out on the innate desires and behaviors that didn't get acknowledgement from a caretaker, from the other kids in school, from teachers, that we're courting annihilation, what the Buddha called uchara, destruction. That childhood fear that mommy, daddy didn't love me when I acted scared, when I acted independent, when I acted, you know, when I had opinions, when I didn't have opinions, when I acted masculine, when I acted feminine, when I did all this stuff, I didn't get love. So to act out on this now, we still have this ingrained fear. And the Buddha had a wonderful, wonderful sutta called the Fena Sutta, where he compares most people's lives, he said, are like somebody who hears that there's this kind of wood called the heartwood, which is the most vaunted and loved and wanted of all the woods. And he goes into his backyard and he sees a banana tree. He's like, oh great, I can get that wood that everybody will buy and love. And he chops it down. And then he chops the, you know, the leaves, whatever the fuck a banana tree has, off. No idea. And then, so apparently, I looked this part up. Apparently, the banana tree doesn't actually have any wood. It's just all fibrous. So he keeps pulling the fiber off and the fiber off, and there's nothing there. There's no heartwood there. And he becomes disgusted. What this means is the more we suppress and the more we avoid and the more we don't acknowledge, the more we create this feeling of a lack. There's something wrong with us. Because we have this what Jung called the shadow self. We have this darkness that we've pushed, suppressed all these authentic needs and behaviors down into. So we feel there's something wrong with us, and then we look for stuff to fill it. In my case, drugs and alcohol did very nicely for many years. Until they didn't, but that's another story. So you get the idea, this constant performing and suppression creates the sense that there's something missing. And there is something missing. We've disavowed parts of ourselves that we don't think people want to see, including ourselves. We compartmentalize so much. So the Buddha at the end of the sutta said, instead of disavowing, we need to bring mindfulness. And the beauty of mindfulness is that it establishes for ourselves in our internal experience all of the things that the infant needed from its caretaker. We're giving ourselves attention and secure connection. We're seeing everything without judging it. We are no longer pushing ourselves away. We're no longer saying, this part of me is not good enough. This is the part that other people don't like. We are opening to each and every desire and emotion and feeling that arises, and we are acknowledging it. And we are not adding the shaming that gives the sense that there's something emotionally unacceptable about what we have. And we're also doing the, besides the mirroring, where we know what each mood and each thought is, what it's trying to say, but we're also marking, which means with awareness, we know what's passing through, but we are not shaken or stirred or reactive to it. So we are aware, we're not judging, we're receptive. But at the same time, when I have a childhood fear come up, and I acknowledge it and I say, hello. I don't resist it. I don't, on the other hand, let it determine how I'm going to behave. I just say, I see you there, but I'm an adult now, and I allow you and I encourage you to visit me, but I am going to take another course. The Buddha didn't say the solution is to act out on all of our authentic desires. When I was a kid, that would probably involve me running around the street naked, hurling feces at people. So you wouldn't particularly want to see that, especially now. With mindfulness, we greet everything that's passing through, but that doesn't mean we act out on it. For this, the Buddha proposed sila, which is basically asking ourselves first and foremost, before I act out on anything, is it going to be harmful to myself or others, especially in the long term? One of my teachers says that this is not about as much letting go of a lot of our authentic desires as figuring out a way to accomplish them that doesn't cause harm to ourselves or others. We can still want to play music or dance or sing aloud or act out on any desire that we've abandoned and disavowed over the years, but the question becomes, how do I do this without causing harm to myself or others? When we do this, we don't add shame into the mix. It's interesting that if we follow the social rewarded path, the performative, what often happens is we develop secretive, shameful little areas where we act out. People binge eat. I had somebody I was working with, and he would once a month go and sneak into a porn magazine shop and buy the magazines and then go home, and I guess he would jerk off. And I was amazed that nobody had told him about the internet, to be frankly. But it's because he was so striving to be successful, even though he was working in a job he couldn't have given a shit about, that he needed to have this little pleasure that was secreted, where he got to act out on some fantasy that was outside of the seeking love at all costs for others. So the good news is, what I'm trying to say here, is that we can give ourselves the secure connection that we've strived for all our lives for. We can give it to ourselves. And we don't have to, it's not just only about me giving it to myself. If I need to, I can see a therapist, I can hang out with my community members, and I can go to them, and I can find people who give support. But at the very least, no matter what, unconditionally, I have an awareness that says, hello, I see you. I'm not abandoning you. You're okay what you're feeling right now. We're going to be okay. And I can take that six-year-old and we can march together through life. And I don't have to perform at least as much as I used to. So I thank you for listening. I hope there was something in there worth reflecting on. Thank you so much. Thank you to each and every one of you for coming. It was an honor.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.